Welcome to the Movies on the Brain podcast. I am one of your hosts, Brian C. Wood. With me this afternoon is our co-host, as always,
Sam Mitz.
Welcome to another weird, wild, and wacky week in the world of genre movie news. So, Chad, tis the season to be jolly. It is also tis the season to be filled with film. Your thoughts, sir, on our holiday season of films and the fact that Mortal Instruments is the greatest of them all.
I know every time we've talked about Aquaman, I've always said something like that. You know, Aquaman should probably move because there's a whole bunch of movies coming out right at the same time, and it's probably going to get trounced, and it needs to move. Not included in that whenever I mentioned that was Mortal Instruments, because I forgot that was a thing, and I continue to forget it was a thing.
A lot of people forgot that was a thing.
Now, to my credit, I remember before you told me you were going to see it.
And then twice.
And I only remember because I saw a tweet that said, if you want to see Mortal Engines, do yourself a favor and have your friend just kick you in the privates. You have a better time. And I was like, wait, is that coming out now? And I looked it up and I'm like, oh, it is. Why? And then I found out that you're a lunatic and that you went to see it multiple times. So,
and paid money both times.
Peter Jackson needs to like reach out personally and thank you for your support and what you're trying to do for Mortal Instruments, because nobody else is going to see it. How many people in there?
The second time?
Either time.
Well, there were five of us in the first screening, and then the second screening, it was just me in the IMAX auditorium.
It was the first time in IMAX?
No, the first time was in one of the small theaters on the side. So it's just me sitting in a 300-seat auditorium by myself up at the top, just chilling, watching this crazy Mad Hatter-type movie that, like, fills in so many tropes and has bad Hugo Weaving chewing scenery and Penelope Boykins trying her best to do her, you know, let's take all of this dense, very weird mythology and let's explain it to people really complexly all throughout the film. And it worked in Lord of the Rings. Did not work, not work so much here. But it's full of tropes and it's bright and it's colorful and it's interesting. But I mean, I can see why a average movie goer would not want to sit through two hours and 15 minutes of that.
Yeah, hearing you describe it, I want no part in none of that.
I take joy in the fact that there is somewhere a 4-hour cut of that film that I will get to see one day.
Jeez, man, why?
Because these people don't know how to do short films. I mean, they did three Lord of the Rings movies and three Hobbit movies. I mean, come on now.
Yeah, and The Hobbit is not a movie that needs to be three. I've still never seen the third one.
That's a benefit to you in society. I, on the other hand, was a nut job, and I saw all three of them in theaters in high rate of frame. So I paid $22 a ticket to see the high rate of frame all three times.
Like, I don't think that would have bothered me so much, particularly like a couple years ago. Now I don't know if I'd be able to handle that, and I understand what you're trying to do, but you got to ease me more into it, man. That's enough. We spent 5 minutes talking about this crazy movie that nobody's gonna see.
$8 million opening weekend on a $110 million budget.
Like, Aquaman made $8 million like last night.
Yeah.
See, this is the kind of stuff that, I mean,
I choose my heels to die on.
Yeah. Really weird heels. I'll give you that. If you want to be a pioneer for something, you are the pioneer for heels that nobody else is ever going to die on.
Uma Thurman makes a good poison ivy.
That's not a bad heel.
Yeah.
That's not a bad heel. I think she would have made a good poison ivy in a better movie. And the movie she was in, I mean, when in Rome, Arnold Schwarzenegger is painted blue and he's spouting off ice puns the whole movie. Yeah, go nuts, Poison Ivy. But if you put her in a regular Batman movie as Poison Ivy, I think she'd have been great. So that's not a bad hit. All right, enough of crazy.
So let's start with the what I think is the bigger surprise of the two, which is Bumblebee. How did somebody not sit in a room 2 years ago, 3 years ago, and say, hey, these are 80s kids' toys. These things became popular in the 80s. let's do a let's set them in the 80s. Let's set them their beginnings there. You know, the Bay films went all kind of crazy, and then you've got Bumblebee flying around in World War II, and you've got, you know, you've got Bumblebee, you know, you got Transformers going all the way back to the Knights of Arthur and all this other crazy stuff. Like, they kept adding and building their mythology as they went, from, you know, Sam Witwicky finding out that, you know, the cube was hidden in the Hoover Dam, and, like, you know, it had been, Transformers had not been a thing that human beings had seen, to, you know, oh, they've been around since, you know, Arthur times, and, mm-hmm. you know, while they may have been just one or two of them in the first movie, they've multiplied and grown over the course of seven movies. So, why did no one think to be like, let's just start in the 80s? Let's do a period piece. It's small and intimate. Let's use the Gen 1 designs. And let's tell the story of Cybertron and of, you know, Earth and the Transformers on Earth through that 80s lens. Because that's, to me, what apparently everybody's loving right now.
So the key to that is your time frame. You said, what, 4 or 5 years ago? At that time.
2 or 3 years ago, well, yeah.
Okay. So still at that time.
Bay is
king, and his movies are making $1 billion every time they come out. No matter how bad they are. And nobody's messing with that formula until he decides to kill the franchise by making Marky Mark the last night in the last movie. And people are like, I'm done. I'm taking my hands off of it. So I think because that movie failed, right when this movie's in development, it gives us the freedom to go to the part that everybody loves about Transformers. Everybody that loves Transformers, even if they're younger, everybody knows the G1 Transformers. Like, I've had faith in this movie because it's Travis Knight and he did Kubo, and I love Kubo. But I was like, okay, I'm going to give you money and probably give you money more than once as soon as I saw G1 Optimus roll out of there with the big cannon that he's holding. It doesn't come out of his hand. And it's like, sold. And then you give me Soundwave and Shockwave, and they all look like the toys that I wanted when I was a kid. I'm like, I'm in this. So, and I still haven't seen it. I'll probably see it this weekend. From what I heard, like, the beginning of the movie, for all those people that like their Transformers without humans, the beginning of the movie, that's going to be for you. It's strictly Cybertron. It looks like all the old stuff from Cybertron. People are going to love that. Apparently, Optimus shows up again at the end, and people are going to love that. So, and in the middle, it seems like the movie's like, I've still never seen the Iron Giant, but that's what I keep hearing.
Yeah, you definitely get some Iron Giant feels from those trailers.
So, I mean, I think it all comes down to people hate it. Like, personally, I hated the Bay design on the Transformers because it just, outside of Optimus and Bumblebee, I couldn't tell you who the rest of them were because they all looked alike. His aesthetic for the Transformers, just, I understood what he wanted. You know, machines always got these gears and everything's always moving, but for Transformers, like, it doesn't give them any personality. This definitely gives them personality. And it was just a bunch of noise. There's no story. Every movie came out and rewrote their history from the movie they had before. And you're still working with the same people working on these movies. So it's like, clearly you don't care, so why should I? This movie seems to, like, goes back to the ground up, gives you a story that focuses on, from what I hear, focuses on Haley Steinfeld and Bumblebee. It shrinks the story down. You get big stuff at the end, but a more focused story in the middle. I think that's all it takes.
Yeah. I mean, we've been proponents of Knight taking on this role. We were just concerned about how much freedom he would have.
Yep.
Given all the mayhem that was going on behind the scenes. Look, if you're going to give me Gen 1 designs, if you're going to give me a great, heartfelt story, and you're going to set everything up for a potential Optimus movie that is just like this, I'm down. Like, make one good movie, tell one good story, and then let's go from there. And I think that by this film having a 90-something% on Rotten Tomatoes, which nobody would have expected a Transformers movie, of any kind to have that kind of a score says a lot. And the fact that it's going to make money, and the fact that people are going to fall in love with Bumblebee the way that, you know, they wanted to in that Bay trilogy, or that Bay set of films, I think just says a lot about the difference between sound and fury signifying nothing and story and character. Mm-hmm. There was a great quote by Amy Pascal, because she came out and she said, look, I'm all in favor of the Marvel deal. Let's keep this going for as long as we can. Like me and Avi were sitting there for years on the Raimi films, talking and hatching and trying to figure out how to do this thing. And the entire time we had a guy sitting over in the corner who was smarter than both of us, and we didn't know it.
Did she actually say that?
She actually said that. And then she said, you know, the thing that I've learned most from Kevin is the fact that it's all about story and character and heart. If you have those three things and you focus on those three things, you can make a good movie. And so when you have those Bay films, which are so bombastic and so over the top and so pandering to China and all of the other stuff, you've got Stanley Tucci running around as drunk Merlin. You've got, you know,
oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah, you've got Stanley Tucci running around as drunk Merlin, which I would actually pay an entire movie to see. You have, you know, Stanley Tucci's, you know, entrepreneur guy in the Age of Extinction. You have the Megan Fox debacle for two films. You have, you know, the parents of Sam Witwicky. You have all of this, the Chicago getting destroyed three times over. Like, you have all of these big bombastic. I mean, the last hour and a half of all of Bay's films are just mindless action that goes nowhere and has no point. And, you know, the reason that, so like, me and you are pro wrestling fans. You want to explain to someone or show someone an example of why we love professional wrestling. You put on the Taker HBK match from WrestleMania 25. There are two guys in their prime of their, you know, a little past the prime of their careers, in an arena filled with thousands of people, telling a story in the ring. Forget the story that they had told for 6 weeks through promos. They were telling a story in that ring with their facial expressions, with their emotions, with their actions. And you bought it hook, line, and sinker, and it grabbed you because you cared about the streak, and you cared about HBK's career. And it just, you knew their history personally going back a decade. That helped make that match personal and meaningful and made it better. The same way here. If I care about Bumblebee, if I care about Hayley Steinfeld's character, if I care about John Cena and making sure that John Cena gets defeated, I'm more apt to get emotionally invested, and therefore I'm going to care more, and I'm going to, you know, want to see more. And, you know, that's to me the difference. Character and heart and story versus sound and fury signifying nothing. And I'm glad we're in a place now where hopefully they've learned small, simple movies that have modest budgets that can still tell a really good story, at least for a little while.
Yeah, I'm really going to be looking to see the legs of this one. I mean, it's not going to make the monster numbers that...
It's not going to make Jumanji money.
Yeah, but...
But if it can have the legs of Jumanji, where it can go for 3 or 4 weeks and stay in the top five, I think that would be a really good thing for them.
Yeah, and this movie's all about restoring faith. So if it has the legs, they see that it's received well from the critics. If it has legs, they see that it's received well by the fans. I think we'll get another movie in the same vein in the summer where they can do more, but still keep the focus on what's the most important.
Well, I mean, the December quarter is about to be vacated by the galaxy far, far away. And the Land of Blue People is going to try to reclaim it, but we're not sure how well that's going to turn out. I mean, you could potentially use this corridor for your small, intimate Transformers movies, especially if you're going to go with an Optimus one next, which seems to be what is suggested by the movie. The execution is done really well because it's a guy who, yes, has a bunch of money on his own, but it's a guy who has spent the last 10 years making stop-motion animated movies with tons of heart and tons of character development.
Yep.
And whether or not you can find somebody else in Hollywood who wants to do that or can do that would be really, really interesting. Of course, the rumors floated around there for a little while that he was in, you know, discussions with Marvel. That, of course, didn't pan out to be true. But, you know, I think it would be interesting. An Optimus Prime movie made by, you know, an Optimus Prime movie made with the same creative team with Knight, I think would be a really interesting thing. Because Optimus, while he's gotten a bunch of screen time over the course of 5 or 6 Bay movies, he really hasn't had that much development.
I would actually say that he's regressed.
Right.
Because we've gone from, like, the Optimus I know, like...
The noble Optimus.
Yeah, like, I know this is lame and all that, but, like, I learned valuable, noble, heroic leader lessons from cartoon Optimus in the 80s. And that Optimus showed up in the first movie, and by the last movie, I didn't see that guy, because this is the guy's, like, basically said, yelling, go ahead, kill him, and that is not Optimus. Yes, Optimus will blast you in the face, but he's not, like, he's not malicious in it. He's doing it because that's his duty to, and he's doing it to serve and protect the as he says, all sentient beings that deserve freedom. And by the end of those movies, it's just like, I'm killing to kill. So that's not the Optimus I want to see. I haven't seen the movie, but then they started showing the commercials in the last couple of weeks. There's this one scene that they put it in all the commercials, and it's this Optimus, and he jumps out with the big cannon, and he does like a little tuck roll, and he says, I'm coming, or I'm here, or something like that. And every time I stop, because I know that moment's coming, and I'm like, that's Optimus. That's Optimus right there. So that's what they're going to give me. Sign me up. You can take a couple checks from me. Let's go.
Yeah, after years of Transformers fans being forced to endure, you know, painful memories.
Yeah, like, Transformers 2, man. Optimus, like, they tried to get us to really have the whole death of Optimus thing. And he was still, you know, I was still borderline feeling Optimus in that one. So, but I just hated Bezos. I hated that Optimus had those stupid flames. And the only reason they had those stupid flames was because Michael Bay thought it was cool. It is literally the only reason. Like, I didn't like that, you know, they changed his big rig design. Okay, I can live with that. But he has red and blue flames solely because that guy thought it was cool. That's it. Like, dumb. It's just stupid.
Indeed. So, Chad, there is a Spider-Verse, and it is making tons of money. We've both seen Into the Spider-Verse. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts on Miles Morales' engaging tale that is wowing audiences all around the world?
That is, just looking at it, it is a simply gorgeous movie. It's when they first showed us what the movie's gonna look like, it's like, this is animation. I haven't seen this style of animation before. And then to watch the movie, the animation is beautiful in the way they use it. It's they really were going for bringing a comic book to life, and the way the movie plays out, that's what they do. I love that movie. I want to see it again. I really wish I could see it again in IMAX, but doesn't look like that's gonna happen because, you know, there's another movie in IMAX right now. But there are moments in that movie that, like, this movie is full of heart, and that's what it is. And I've written it a couple places, like, this is a love letter to Spider-Man, not just Peter, not just Miles. I mean, it is Miles' movie, and I'm glad that it's solely Miles' movie. But this is just a love letter to, if you love Spider-Man, this is the movie for you. I can't believe that they made this movie. I can't believe I sat there and watched the movie that has freaking Spider-Ham in it, that deals with a bunch of stuff that I don't like dealing with its parallel universes coming together. I hate that stuff. And they did all of that, balanced all those different characters. Spider-Ham, freaking Nicolas Cage as Spider-Man Noir, balance it all together, and it still feels like Miles' movie, and it all comes together, and it feels like there's no wasted motion in the movie. So, I give it my highest marks.
Indeed. Somewhere Kathleen Kennedy is crying because she's like, maybe we should have let these guys do what they wanted to do. Lord and Miller have not taken a victory lap, surprisingly. They have not addressed questions about what went on, but they haven't taken a victory lap after this either, which is really interesting to me. Great film, great use of Miles Morales, great way to introduce him to mainstream. Interesting that it sets up the possibility to me that if you wanted to play the story out in the MCU, that Donald Glover could now be the Prowler, which would be an interesting way to go for a Spider-Man Far From Home, if they wanted to go that route.
I don't know how many people that don't know Spider-Man knew that the Prowler in this movie was the character that Donald Glover played in Homecoming. But see, that this is my only thing with Miles. I think for Miles to exist, and the movie touches on this, because every Spider character in that movie, all of them have their moment where they turn into Spider-Man, it all hinges upon somebody dying that's close to them. Or that they end up looking up to.
Which is why you have that line about nobody understands. Yes, we do. All of us do.
Yeah. But for Miles, like, it's their Uncle Ben moment. Right. They all have the Uncle Ben moment. For Miles, Miles' Uncle Ben is Peter. Peter dies. When Miles first shows up in the comics, it's Ultimate Spider-Man. Ultimate Peter Parker dies. In this movie, spoilers, the Spider-Man of Miles Earth dies. He watches him die. So, Miles' moment, just like Uncle Ben has to die for Peter, Miles has to watch Peter die, which is why I don't know how you do him in the movies, because...
Well, this isn't MCU.
Well, no, you can do it, like, into the Spider-Verse, yeah, you can do it. But if you do it, if you want to do live action in the MCU, Peter's got to die. And they're not about to kill this Peter.
Well, there's going to be a Sinister Six movie. And also, you have to understand that Miles is that his nephew Miles, who is referenced in Homecoming, is not age specific. So, you know, Miles could be an infant for all we know at this point in the MCU.
I mean, if you wanted to do it, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't kill Peter Parker.
I would assume that we're going like for the MCU or the MCU / Sony version. I think we're heading toward a Sinister Six for a Sinister Six movie for whatever the third Spider-Man solo film is going to be. Because I think you're going to lay the groundwork with maybe Chameleon and Mysterio in this film. We already know Scorpion and Vulture are out there, and we know that there could be an Osborn at play, possibly at some point. And then you would have a Sinister Six, which is something Sony had wanted to do with Drew Goddard at one point, and you can do it, and then at the end of that, whatever you want to do.
Well, so...
use Prowler in the Sinister Six.
Since Sony still hasn't released the dang trailer for Far From Home, which I don't understand the move in not releasing that in front of Into the Spider-Verse, but, you know, whatever.
Well, Marvel kind of screwed them, because it was like they got pushed back a couple of days because of HW's death, and then...
I mean, I get that you don't want to do it right after Infinity War, but, I mean, the movie...
You mean Endgame?
I mean, yeah, Endgame. Endgame. But the movie's been out for like a week. There's nothing stopping you from doing it last week. So I've read the trailer descriptions. You could do a Sinister Six with what they're introducing. Mysterio will be in this movie. Apparently, there's going to be... Vulture's still around.
And Scorpion, who was introduced in the Stinger.
But apparently, Hydro Man's in play. And maybe some other people. They refer to them as elementals, and it seems like there's more than one. And I know Hydro Man is one of them, which will make me think that Sandman is one of them. So there you go. You got a bunch of people in just these two movies. So if they wanted to go that route, cool. It would just make me angry, because in my mind, when you did the Sinister Six with Spider-Man, that would always be when I introduced the damn symbiote, because it's six of them. He's going to get destroyed the first time. He needs an edge the second time. The strong suit is the edge. But we got this stupid thing over here called Venom.
$800 million, Jack.
There's no reason this should have made $800 million. China. What are you doing? Whatever.
$825 million.
It's more than Deadpool now, right? It's officially over Deadpool. This movie... It just... So they've released two successful Spider-Man movies this year, Venom and Into the Spider-Verse. Both things... One I'm very much a fan of and want Sony to keep doing those. The other one just makes me wish Sony would go ahead and sell the rights back to Disney. However, in doing that, it would pretty much ensure that the other thing that I really love doesn't happen again, because Disney ain't making that movie.
Well, they didn't want to be in bed with those guys. So, I mean, you have to understand, in a pitch meeting somewhere, that movie sounds absolutely nuts.
It does.
Like there's no way on paper that movie should work.
When they said a Miles movie, I'm like, cool, we get a Miles movie. When they said a Spider-Verse movie, I'm like, no, I don't want nothing to do with that. And then I saw what it looked like, I'm like, it looks pretty, I'll go see it. And then I saw it, I'm like, what do I know?
You know what else we did that with? No one wants a solo movie. A Han Solo movie can't possibly work. It'll be a horrible botch job. No one needs that much backstory. And, oh, wait, you got the guys from Jump Street to come do this? And they've got this long track record of success and doing things that really shouldn't turn out well, really well? Okay, I'm on board. And then you know what happened, Chad? Kathleen Kennedy fired those people.
Yeah.
Over creative differences, because Lawrence Kasdan's old wrinkly butt was too butthurt to let them do whatever they were going to do. And so instead we end up with Paul Bettany being really, really weird in a movie that is, you know, was going to give us more Darth Maul. That was and just a reminder to folks, that was a movie that came out this year.
Yeah, that's true. leaving Solo, I was like, you know, I'm fine with this movie. Seeing Into the Spider-Verse does make me curious as to what their version would have looked like. But I'm completely fine, like, writing this off as a, oh, well, we'll never know. There are some things I don't let go. I'm completely fine just letting it slip off.
See, this is how I feel about Drew Goddard's Sinister Six. Like, you know, I saw Cabin in the Woods. I know how good that of writing that in character development that guy can do. I saw Bad Times at El Royale. I seen what that guy can do with a movie star on Chris Hemsworth. Like, give me that guy doing a comic book movie, a straight-up comic book movie, having worked with Joss Whedon. Like, that would have been awesome. That would have been the thing that would have saved their rear ends on the Amazing Spider-Man trilogy. Unfortunately, Mark Webb had to go and, you know, not be a strong man and get hung with, you know, the title of making two bad movies with a great actor and Andrew Garfield.
I would say two bad movies. One okay movie and one... I'm not as down on those two movies as everybody else. However, the second one was not the best.
Again, Avi and Amy just sitting there having conversations, and a little guy over here in the corner with his comic books open and just not talking. Very quiet.
I blame Avi.
Well, as Jim pointed out on our interview that we'll try to get up this week, even though it's bad quality, Avi's closer to getting an Oscar than Feige is, because if Feige doesn't get Black Panther nominated, you know, they're gonna win Best Animated Feature for Into the Spider-Verse.
They will, unless they Lego movie him.
And then it will be Academy Award winner Avi Arad.
Good things happen to people that they shouldn't sometimes. We just gotta take that.
See Alex Kurtzman and Mr. Goldsman.
Yeah. I mean, how much did Ivy really have to input in that movie? Outside of his name being...
And putting some money up.
He just kind of shows up. And if it's like, oh, Spider-Man? I'm right here. I'm just gonna sit right here. Oh, it's a cartoon. I'm gonna sit in the corner over there. But I'm in the room, so pay me.
So let's move on to the Aquaman. Fun time. Action-adventure time at the movies.
So I've seen it, you haven't.
Yeah, apparently your tweet was something along the lines of, everything we've made fun of Aquaman for over the years is in this film, and somehow it still works.
Yes, yes. Like, if you've seen any Aquaman joke ever, it's in this movie.
If you've seen Entourage.
See, I've never seen Entourage, yeah. But like the him riding the seahorse, him talking to the animals, and they have that weird wave, and it makes that sound. Just anything that we made fun of Aquaman for is in this movie, and I'm like, and it comes off as cool, which is a feat all in its own. As for the movie itself, I think its general reaction have been generally positive. However, the people that don't like it really don't like it. I think the opinions are gonna vary greatly. Like, I like the movie. It's got some things. It's got things wrong with it. It is entirely too long. You could have cut out 30 minutes of that movie. Unfortunately, if you cut out 30 minutes of that movie, you pretty much take out most of the Black Manta stuff, which is some of the coolest stuff in there. When he's in there, I liked him. But you didn't need him in the movie except for like the beginning and the end. I hated the score. Like, it was distractingly bad. Like, there were times I was like, it pulled me out of the movie listening to it, like, this sucks, man. Why? I get what you're going for, but you're bad at it. You're trying to go for epic, heroic, and it's, I can hear that's what you're trying to do, but that ain't what this is. Like, outside of that, I mean, it's Aquaman, so that, with that comes an inherent amount of goofiness. And if you're an Aquaman fan or know Aquaman lore, you're probably going to have problems with Jason Momoa, because he is not that Aquaman. He is the Aquaman that we got in Justice League. He is that.
He is Dude Bro Aquaman.
Yeah, he grows a little bit towards the end, but that's still who he is. But visually, it looks very good. There are some parts that, you know, a little wonky, but when this movie is supposed to take place, mostly undersea, and that means everything undersea is CG, I can forgive a little lapses here and there. Some people have problems with Jason Momoa and Amber Heard's chemistry. I did not. I was fine with them being together. Her wig is still stupid, but, you know, what are we going to do? And generally, all the people that are in it, the actors that are in it, they're doing a good job. They're like, going for it.
Even
Willem Dafoe. I know, speaking of them, dialogue is an issue with a lot of people. I guess I just knew that going in, so it did. There's some lines, they didn't bother me watching it, but as I think back about them, I'm like, yeah, you probably could have done that a little bit better. But, I mean, overall, it's, if you're going to the movie for fun, this movie will be fun. Of the DC movies, just like color tone and actually tone of the movie, it's different from almost from everything. The closest thing to it, surprise, surprise, is going to be Wonder Woman. But it's the brightest movie of all of them. Like, strikingly so. Like, watching the movie, I look at Mira, and in my mind, I'm thinking back to when Mira and Aquaman met in Justice League. And even though that movie's brightened up, it ain't nothing to what this is, because it's just big and beautiful the whole time. So, out of the DC movies, it's probably third for me. And it's on the good end. So, if you want fun, if you want to see a DC movie that is fun, it knows it's trying to be fun, first and foremost, this is your movie.
And your post-credit singer?
I think it's only the mid-credit singer. I hope it is, because I didn't say it at the end. It's more set up for Black Manta. I can say that and not spoil anything.
So, heading more toward a sequel for Aquaman, less toward setting up whatever other thing.
Yeah, it's more about
which, Aquaman. Which has pretty much seemed to be the case, that they're ignoring completely the Justice League, as they should.
It's weird, because they are, but they're not. Because it's specifically referenced in this movie that Aquaman's been, he's met Mera, and he went off and fought Steppenwolf. She says that in the movie. So, they're referencing events that happened before, but so it's in this world, but it's not. It's not like there's not any more ties to it.
There's no 6 months later.
Yeah, there's none of that kind of stuff. I mean, he still has. He has the, I guess, the trident that he had in Justice League. They explain that, and the whole stuff with her saying talking about Steppenwolf, but that's it. And really and truly, for a shared universe, that's kind of all you need. You don't even have to
like, look at Wonder Woman.
Yeah,
like there's the Wayne Enterprises armored car at the beginning. There's the whole thing about the photo, which had been in Dawn of Justice. Mm-hmm. And you just go from there, and you get some stuff at the beginning and some stuff at the end, and everything else is about her.
Wonder Woman is more force than Aquaman is, because it really is just like a line that she says. And I think that's like, people really want to throw out the baby with the bathwater and be like, they need to just do solo movies and forget about trying to connect them. But if you connect them like this, there's no. Why not?
Short, sweet, and, you know, gives you options. And that's what they need right now, is options. And that's why we will see if, you know, Danny Garcia has stated that he did not hang up the cape, still have that cape lying around, if there were some negotiations, and Superman can show up at the end of Shazam, and then we could, you know, continue to be on this kind of smallish connection route. You know, maybe we could get to a second Justice League movie that would necessarily deal with
Darkseid.
And to be honest, you would just have to find the right director for that material, because clearly Joss wasn't up to what they needed, because he was being, you know, him getting roasted on the internet for Justice League blows my mind, because here's the guy brought in literally at the last minute to reshoot 3/4 of the film. It's kind of like Ron Howard. Ron Howard gets killed for Solo, but I mean, like, you know, he's a workman director. He's not somebody who has this big, flashy eye. He doesn't have a aesthetic that, like, screams, this is a Ron Howard film. If you just want a movie that is made quality, you know, good, decent, workman-like, cheap, you know, come in on time and on budget and in good quality, you go hire Ron Howard.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a working relationship for years going back to the 80s. You know, of course, he got his start in American Graffiti with George Lucas. I mean, there were a lot of ties there. So, like, I can't roast Ron Howard for what happened on Solo. Same way I can't roast Joss Whedon for being roped in. And here, by the way, here's the bonus of a Batgirl movie that'll never happen. But, like, I can't roast him for that.
Like, it's the equivalent. You're giving him, you're saying, okay, I want you to go fight that guy. But before you fight that guy, I'm going to tie your arm and one of your legs behind your back. Good luck, champ. It's he landed a punch. It's a miracle that happened. You can't fault him, either one of them, for being in a situation where the movie's halfway shot, or in Joss's case, most of the movie shot, and then you have to go back and reshoot like half of it.
They were 3 weeks away from finishing filming on both of those.
Yeah, no. See,
you can't do that, especially on an extremely special effects heavy movie like Justice League. There's no way you can change that whole third act. It just can't be done. And, you know, to roast Joss for that is just wrong, in my opinion. And so if you want to move toward doing another Justice League, because people are apparently liking Dubrow Aquaman, they love them some Gal Gadot Wonder Woman, Henry Cavill has a strong fan base of support for his Superman, that means that the only thing, and you kind of redeemed, you know, Cavill Superman in Justice League, that just leaves the Batflack, which, you know, was probably the character that got most defiled, if you want to use that word, by the Snyder Murderverse. Murder Bat became a thing because of him, right? I don't necessarily know that you need Ben. Ben's dealt with a lot in the last 4 years, personally and professionally. I personally think he needs to go back to being the Argo Ben Affleck, where he's making his movies, doing things his way. I will maintain till the day I die that Live by Night would have worked if it had been an HBO miniseries and not a feature film. And he could have directed episodes and show ran that and done been really successful. But if you wanted to change out for someone, say, Arnie Hammer, for Affleck, you don't have to change anything.
Yeah.
You can do the Rhodes thing and be like, I'm here, let's move on, let's deal with it, and go. You can maintain the same continuity. Superman is dead. Superman has been resurrected. You know, you stopped the Steppenwolf invasion, but now you got to get ready for this dark side thing. You keep Lex Luthor as Jesse Eisenberg. And if you want to move creatively in a direction where you want to deal with Deathstroke, you can do that. You know, but I don't think, based off of if you've got a working Wonder Woman, a working Aquaman, and a working Superman, all with fan bases, all with support, all people who like those character, those actors' iterations of their character, just change out a Batman and, you know, from all intents and purposes, everything we've heard for the last 2 years now about Matt Reeves' Batman movie has pretty much been that it's going to be a pseudo year one interpretation where the younger Batman, so it's pretty much set in the past, so you don't really have to answer those questions in that film. Just bring in an Arnie Hammer or somebody to fill that role, get Affleck out, but use the same mythology, and let's go have a Justice League movie with a good director that you think can work with that material suitably.
Yeah, that I think Ben is the actor that has been most associated with all of the failings of Batman vs. Superman and Justice League, and because he's been so, I'm out, I'm in, I'm out, I'm in, people are more willing to like just say, okay, fine, he can go. With the fact that we've already had a Batman franchise that's supposedly all set together, where we had three different guys play Batman, people are more forgiving of switching out Batman.
Most people don't know that, though. Most people don't know that the Burton Batman, the Schumacher Batmans, are all supposed to be the same guy.
Yeah, and well, at this point, I would imagine they would. I mean, those movies reference the other ones, but...
Yeah, they do, but, I mean, like, for most people, the Dark Knight trilogy is their version of Batman if you're under 30. So,
yeah, I would say, yeah, I would agree with that. But as for Superman, I think Aquaman, the success of Aquaman, is the best thing for Cavill as Superman. Because all before, everybody's saying, you got to, you know, cut off all visual cues of...
The Snyderverse.
The Snyderverse. And the biggest visual cues are the ones that have been in the most movies, which is Batman, Superman. Yeah, Wonder Woman was in it, but her movie went and succeeded. Aquaman comes along and is like, well, we're already down this track. Well, let's see. It's probably going to bomb. Whatever.
It's going to win December.
Yeah, it's going to win December. So Jason Momoa is here to stay as Aquaman. So it's like, well, I guess all we really need to do is, like, we can keep these guys, but change the aesthetic of the movies. And that's what I've been saying the whole time. So now it's a matter of WB changing their mind on wanting to move away from Cavill, because I truly believe Cavill wants to stay in the role. I don't think there's been a hard, fast decision made yet. I think Aquaman was going to dictate a lot of things, and I think it's going to, now with the success, going to dictate a lot of things in a positive direction. I still don't think we get a Justice League movie for a while, which I don't want a Justice League movie for a while.
Well, what you've got is Shazam, which doesn't fit into Justice League at all. But you've got Shazam, and then you've got Wonder Woman 2. You don't have another Superman movie. There hasn't been a solo Superman movie since Man of Steel.
Yeah.
You've let the anniversary come and go without any new Superman stuff possible. So you could do a Man of Steel 2, which has been floated around for years. You know, Matthew Vaughn apparently, unfortunately, has sucked himself so far deep into the Kingsman hole that I don't think he's ever coming out. But you could find another quality director with a good take on a Superman story, especially with Cavill Superman, who's been through so much. Unlike, you know, the closest thing I could compare it to is Reeves, because Reeves had four solid movies as his Superman.
Mm.
This Superman has so much history now in this universe that he's a rich, you can do a little bit more character development and give him a really good story. So, you know, you get a Man of Steel 2, and if that succeeds, then you've got a successful Wonder Woman, a successful Aquaman, possibly with one or two sequel by that point, and you've got a successful Superman. All you got to do is just change out Batman, and you're good. And by 2022, if you want to do a Justice League, you're fine.
2022 is probably the earliest I would say they can think about Justice League. Yeah, so we'll get Wonder Woman 2 in 2020. If we're lucky, we'll get Batman in 2021. I mean, feasibly, if they change their mind about Superman, like, tomorrow, feasibly, you could start working on a Superman movie this in 2019, which would get you a Superman movie in 2021, probably. The only thing with that is, I doubt they would want to release Superman and Batman in the same year.
Chad, Disney's releasing an Avengers movie and a Star Wars movie in the same year.
Yeah, Disney's a different beast than WB right now. If you look at Disney's calendar, it's like, y'all are insane. From March to July, it's like Disney. So it's like they're competing with each other in the same month. So they're a whole completely different beast. I wouldn't be opposed to it, but I know they will probably want to put Batman's definitely going to the summer. The only way they'll do both of them in the same year is if they do Batman in the summer and Superman in December, which I'm fine with.
Which was originally the date for Man of Steel, anyway. Yep. So it's
supposed to be December 2012. So if it is 2021, 22, we're like looking at damn near 10 years since we had a solo Superman movie. But I'm hoping that DC sees Aquaman in that light and are like, and tell Danny Garcia to be like, okay, we'll take it back, but you got to slow your roll on some of this stuff, and let's meet right here.
Well, to be honest, he deserves some, like, he's the one who's going to take all this heat for all these bad decisions that have been made. I mean, how much and how many times did he have to defend Man of Steel going all around?
He had to defend every movie he's been in.
Right. And that's not been his responsibility. That's been Snyder's responsibility. It's been the writer's responsibilities. It's been the studio's responsibility. Like, he just wants to say, look, y'all gonna make me do this again? Let me have some story input. Let me have some say in the development of my character, the way that someone, say, like Chris Pratt, has some say over how Star-Lord is portrayed in the Avengers movies.
Now, I'll play Warner Brothers at this point. I'll be like, well, you're not Chris Pratt level. What he should shoot for is, I would add whatever Gal's got, I want that.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's a little bit different with Gal.
Because Gal and Patty work together on that. They're a creative team. Like, they've been working hand in hand from the beginning on developing that one version of Wonder Woman. Zach just kind of had to throw her in there in Dawn of Justice. I mean, as we said many times, she had 12 lines of dialogue, 16 lines of dialogue.
Yeah, something like that.
You know, and she got off a plane and went and fought a giant Doomsday. Like she was just thrown in there. It is Patty and Gal's vision of what, and to some degree, Geoff Johns, their version of what Wonder Woman is, that has defined that character through two movies.
Yeah, and Henry should have something like that. Like, what the Gal had in the beginning, because right now Gal can write her check for whatever she wants and they'll give it to her, but he should get something akin to that.
Yeah, I would agree. So we will be back eventually with a next week with a half and half preview episode, as we do every year, reviewing our 2018 movies that we liked and movies that we didn't like. And we will look through the calendar at 2019, go through month by month, and talk about those things which we are most excited for. This is my humble and sincere plea to all of you that as y'all celebrate the true meaning of Christmas in the spirit of joy and giving, that you give money to your local movie theater and go and see Mortal Engines, so that it may have hope of a resurrection of some kind.
Okay, so one, I'm not doing that. I'm going to see Bumblebee some point this weekend. My brother actually asked me if we were going to go see Mary Poppins, which I was like, why? At first, I mean, I want to see it, but like, if I got every, like, my the youngest brother that asked me that, he wants to see Bumblebee, My middle brother, who doesn't want to see anything, said he wants to see Bumblebee. My kid wants to see Bumblebee. We're going to go see Bumblebee. Like, the fact that he even thought of Mary Poppins just kind of blew my mind. So I'll ask you, are you going to go see Mary Poppins?
I am.
Okay.
Because, I mean, the crazy part to me is that it's tracking down, yet its awards prospects are tracking up. So, like, there are best picture lists out there right now with Mary Poppins Returns on them.
Yeah, I've heard that.
So, like...
That, like, Emily Blunt is, like awards worthy from that. So, yeah, that is quite interesting. So I want to see it. I don't know if I will get to see it.
And, you know, do yourself a favor. Keep up with all the Oscar stuff that's coming, because we're going to be in a really truncated period here. I mean, not too long after the first of the year, you get the nominations, and we'll be on the road to that ceremony with or without a host in March. So,
is it in March?
Late February, last weekend of February.
Okay, that's what I always thought it was, the end of February. But yeah, now that you say that, like, they were saying we don't have a host, I'm like, you know, you got time. But now that I'm thinking about it, no, you don't.
No, and they named a producer a year ago. They named the producers a year out, so pretty much after one ceremony ends, they named the producer for the next one. So she's been on the hunt. And there was a great piece in the Hollywood Reporter before the Kevin Hart news came out that was like, look, no one wants to touch this. And the Academy is wrestling with itself, because there are straight up members of the Academy who were unnerved by the way that Seth MacFarlane hosted. You know, the We Saw Your Boobs song, obviously. Oh, yeah. They were tripped out by Anne Hathaway and James Franco, like, not having very good chemistry together and doing that awkward thing. The consensus has been that, you know, they can't redo the Hugh Jackman thing, the singing and dancing thing. But they also don't want to go back down the rabbit hole of another, you know, white comedian dude. Mm-hmm. So the Academy is trying to push and pull within itself about who they would want. And then you get the stars and actors themselves who are the comedians themselves who are like, I don't want no part of it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Kimmel did a decent job, but, like, it's really hard to get any movement or pop out of being that host. And so what you end up with is a bunch of names. One name that came to my mind, and I tweeted this, was Maya Rudolph, because her and Tiffany Haddish had done a spot on the telecast last year, and they were really funny. The problem was Tiffany Haddish had trouble pronouncing the names because they put her in the foreign language category, and she stumbled over names, and they felt that was disrespectful. So they wouldn't consider her for the role. But I would be totally down for a Kristen Wiig, Maya Rudolph hosting team. They've already reached out multiple years to Amy Poehler and Tina Fey, who both said no thank you. So in your Rolodex of old hosts, which would be, you know, your Billy Crystals and your Whoopi Goldbergs and your David Lettermans and your Stephen Colberts and those kind, and your, you know, Neil Patrick Harris bombed, yeah, like, you're not going to go back to them. Billy's, like, you know, getting up there, and he doesn't really do a whole lot of things anymore. And, like, he's more than happy to make a joke on your telecast about, like, hey, we're already running long 2 minutes in. I mean, he knows the issues. So, like, finding somebody who wants to do that, who needs the publicity from being the host of the Academy Awards, and who's willing to do that is really hard. And then finding somebody the Academy will accept is really hard. And then when you settle on somebody, and, you know, we have a James Gunn situation, and they go back through old tweets, and they're like, hey, look, here. And then they cause you to fold down.
Nobody's really taking it.
Right.
I'm intrigued on what they're going to do.
I've said for years, you don't need a host. That opening monologue is the only thing the host does, and it's the first 10 minutes. After that, it's just introducing the presenters. So here's what you do. We complain and yell and scream every year about how long this damn show is, and that it's the ruination of all things movies, and, you know, why are we having even these awards when we're judging art, when art should not be judged, and yada yada. Keep it simple, man. All you need is your backstage people to, you know, to announce now presenting, you know, and then have your presenters come out and just do awards and just do performances of your songs. If you want to have follow a model, You want something to open the show with? Tom Cruise, the 2002 Oscars, started the show with a monologue written by Cameron Crowe about the importance of film to the healing of the country. It didn't start with a joke. It didn't start with a monologue from a host. It just started with Tom Cruise reading a very poignant message about the meaning of film. You can do that. I mean, we're in a, you know, the Oscars are going to inherently be political anyway. I mean, we have the President of the United States tweeting about Meryl Streep being an overrated actress. Have an introduction about thank you for our year in film, or, you know, a nice speech about what, you know, with all of the Black Panther stuff and all that, the diversity and culture of the, have the Academy President come out. They have to speak anyway. Have the Academy President come out and open the ceremony and then turn it over to the presenters and let's get on the road with it. I mean, you don't need a host. You just need, you know, and introducing.
So I was down with that idea. I still kind of am down with that idea. I did see an opposing point was like, the host does function to like smooth the show along when things do go wrong, like the host pop up. And that's why they tend to get comedians and people to think on their feet. So when stuff goes wrong, they kind of massage the situation and then push it in the way that it needs to go.
The only time I can ever remember that happening or being effective was Kimmel after the envelope situation, who I think he handled that situation as best as anybody could. You know, Jon Stewart's already hosted. I mean, you couldn't pull Jon Stewart out of retirement to do it. I mean, it's just, you go through the list of the last 25 years. Ellen, you gonna go get Ellen to do it again? Right. I mean, you know, Ellen's already done it multiple times. Chris Rock's done it multiple times. You know, Whoopi's definitely not the person you want doing it right now. I mean, you know, who are you going to get? And you reach out and you have a fresh, innovative choice like Kevin Hart, and you end up with the, you know, the scrutiny. So, which I will always maintain was people in the Academy who didn't want him as host, who were like feeding information to outlets and being like, here are these old tweets.
If there was people in the Academy, that's just stupid. Because now look at where you're at.
This, on top of the popular culture Oscar thing, it's been a really bad year for the Academy.
Yeah, that's true.
So, we will see. But, from the Movies on the Brain podcast to you, have a very Merry Christmas season. We will be back next week with a 2018 review, 2019 preview. Until then, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at BCW Tiger Fan.
At the Mets Theory.
Thank you very much, and have a pleasant evening.